a labor and a G in Staples, I feel. Vietnam for some is, as a subject, is a kind of painful experience. For others, it's an embarrassment. Still others, it's a kind of distasteful matter. And for still others, it's all of the above. So there is a certain singularity to it, but it's my task to lead you into a discussion of it, sort of as a ghost of Christmas past, or a little like Coleridge's unwanted wedding party guest. I assume, perhaps with some excessive credulity, that you've all read the paper. No? You have good. Well, that's a majority of one. Actually, there's nothing really new in it, or never said before. It was, I think, actually, most people here have thought a great deal about Vietnam over the years, and perhaps in many instances know a lot more about it than they themselves even realize. Therefore, the paper was written more from the standpoint that not of attempting to educate, but to remind. It is in three parts. The first deals with what I consider to be the constants in the Vietnamese thinking and the Vietnamese political process as it's applicable to external relations. Second part deals with a examination of the three, what you might call bilateral relations, as Hanoi and ASEAN, Hanoi and Indochina, the other two Indochina countries, and Hanoi and China. I'm not even going to really summarize this. I think probably what I should do is, in a sentence or two, outline what I consider to be, and what is the first third of this paper, the internal forces, the factors, which serve as a kind of base in influencing external relation. First of these is a kind of what I term conservative radicalism, which posits a kind of dark, pessimistic, philosophic worldview. It's a general penchant by all Vietnamese to see the world as a filled with untrustworthy, undependable, in which betrayal is the norm, in which it's very difficult to trust. Wisest Vietnamese I ever knew, Dean Thuc at the Faculty of Letters, once said to me, you could write the history of Vietnam in terms of the double cross. Everybody has betrayed us. And this was about 1962. He said, sooner or later, you Americans will betray us. I said, no, you don't understand. We're quite different. Yeah. So it's not without reason that there is this this characteristic. It's a product of heritage, of the whole world of the politics of clandestinism, which for 1,000 years was used to deal with the Chinese and the French. It permeates all levels of the society. The meaning, I think, for particularly for ASEAN countries that are dealing with Vietnam, is that you cannot really expect to appeal to the upbeat, optimistic side of the Vietnamese, because there is none. The second basic constant, and I label these constants, although the discussion suggests that in many instances they are, each of them is in a condition of change, and it's they may not be of the nature that they have been in the past. They are undergoing some sort of a metamorphosis. But second of these is what is called the Dao Chan doctrine. Dao Chan, complicated word, a very golden word in the Vietnamese lexicon. Translation into English is struggle. It is the important word in the lexicon of the Vietnamese communist movement. Chan Dao reversed, which the Southerners have do in a malicious way, means to be gored by an ox. and it's very typical of Vietnamese that the Southerners would use this twist of what is the most important word in the whole lexicon. This is essentially a concept of dealing with problems, military, quasi-military problems, that relevant in the case of ASEAN and its neighbors is that the concept of Dao Chan or struggle, armed Dao Chan, political Dao Chan, conveys or carries over into diplomacy the characteristic or the penchant to treat diplomacy as a quasi-military campaign. The specifics of this, to reduce it from an abstraction to a very concrete delineation, is found on page 7 and 8, which there's about 5 or 6 characteristics of what the application of Dao Chan and the concept of Dao Chan to diplomacy really means. There's more than this to it, but these are sort of the central ones. The meaning, again, the succinct meaning, I think, for ASEAN and those who deal with Vietnam is that the negotiations are not seen in terms of problem solving or in terms of conflict resolution. And those who think that they can establish solutions by this means are up against the formidable wall of Dao Chan, up against a strategy that's being used against them, which I would not say is not insurmountable, but if you ever hope to negotiate with the Vietnamese, you've got to realize that this is where they come from, and you've got to address yourself to this condition and this mindset and this strategy which they're using against you. The third constant is sort of a negative, has to do, it's called, economic schizophrenia. It stems from the fact that one of the most puzzling phenomenons in Vietnam's post-war history has been the great disparity between, within the economic sector, between the obvious dictates of policy and the programs that are actually implemented, between what the officials, the leaders, say that they want to do, assert that they want to do, they actually want to do these things, but what they want to do, the essence of their economic programs are never translated, or policies are never translated into specific programs. At the Fifth Party Congress in 1976, the first party congress after the end of the war, the slogan for the party was "Economics is in command." And the sense of this meant that within certain ideological constraints, economic needs, economic imperatives, economic dictates would determine what was going to be done in foreign affairs, in domestic policy, and so on. Economics in command would mean, for example, that you would have reasonably amicable relations with your neighbors. I think this was the intention, but it was never translated into action. difficulties began with the Chinese, and then with Pol Pot, and at one point, you know, the Vietnamese wound up inadvertently, really, fighting a two-front war. Now, I recognize there are reasons for this on both sides. Chinese are difficult to deal with, and certainly Pol Pot is. But I would argue that a different leadership, even a Ho Chi Minh who is still alive, could have dealt with the Chinese, could have dealt with Pol Pot by means other than were used. That is kind of confrontation. Point is, though, that the intention was to put economics in command, begin national economic development, but foreign policies were not set down, which were designed to serve that, even though the intention was there. Same thing with the middle class in the South, the ethnic Chinese, who were the backbone of the technology of the economy, both North and South, who were driven into the sea. If economics were really in command, the dictates would be that you deal with them, and the Cholon Chinese were, again, a problem, but they could have been dealt with, could have been handled, if there had been this ability to bridge what was the intention and with what actually happened. Now, why there is this gulf is, to me, is something of a puzzle. I've heard probably every explanation that there is possible on it. none of which seems to be, to me, to be very satisfactory. It remains really at that kind of indeterminate stage. Again, the meaning to ASEAN and to outsiders, I think, though, is to disabuse yourself of the notion that economic incentives can induce Hanoi the Vietnamese to behave in a way which it would seem obvious that it would be in their interest to do so. This simply does not work out this way. I think the Russians are the ones who are the most recent witnesses to this and who are experiencing the troubles, the difficulties in trying to influence Hanoi in specific ways through economic incentives. The three of these conditions, I think, sort of add up in sum to what is I call Douglas Pike's second law of Asian politics, which is that every country is its own worst enemy. No country can do to you quite what you can do to yourself. This is rather universally applicable to all the countries on the Pacific Basin, including the United States. Now, the second part deals with the, as I say, the sort of what you might call bilateral relations of Vietnam with Indochina, with ASEAN, and with China. The only one of these that I think is worth singling out, which has particular meaning here, has to do with Indochina. And it addresses itself to the fundamental question of what is going to be the future political configuration of the Indochina Peninsula, that is, of Vietnam, Laos, and Kampuchea, or Kampucha, or Cambodia, as the State Department has now gone back to. These three countries, what is going to be the future political configuration? What would Vietnam settle for, and what would it not settle for? On page 18, there is a hypothesis that I offer, but I think of the minimal needs or the three minimal conditions which I think I offer. This is a hypothesis, you understand, that probably would be at this point satisfactory to the Vietnamese. That's the sort of thing, if there are to be negotiations with the Vietnamese, that is what you ought, whoever does it, ought to try to sound out and get the parameters of their position. Then at the same time, ASEAN, particularly Thailand, but the rest of ASEAN, as well as China, I think have to do the opposite, and they have to address themselves in a fundamental, comprehensive way as to what would they settle for with respect to a future political configuration of Indochina, and what would they not. I do not feel that ASEAN has done this in any systematic way. I feel there is a tendency to concentrate on what, to me, are the superficialities involved, get the Vietnamese troops out of Cambodia, which I do not see as the problem. It's the result of the problem. It's not the cause, it's the effect. You get to the more fundamental questions, and I think the problem of the Vietnamese troops in Cambodia will tend to take care of itself. Vietnamese did not invade Cambodia in the name of federation. They went in to solve the Pol Pot problem. They do not want to keep their troops there. Their troops are bogged down there. This is essentially a result of a blunder. That does not mean they're not amicable or do not hope for some kind of a federated or confederated arrangement in the long run. That's not why they're in Cambodia right now. That's not the purpose of their invasion. And therefore, if we hope to stabilize Cambodia by some new political structure, the first thing that must be done is to identify clearly what the problem is and not get seduced off on sort of peripheral problems. And therefore, with respect to this, all I'm really advising ASEAN to do now is to do some hard and systematic thinking about it. I don't really care too much what you decide. I just think you should put more of a concentrated, systematic effort into doing it. Then the last section deals with leadership. I'm afraid this is kind of this old plaintive cry, God give us men. Naturally, if we had great leaders, why, we wouldn't have any other problems, or very few of them. What should be kept in mind with respect to Vietnam is that the present leadership is concentrated, 15 men of the Politburo, five people really, who are the inner, so-called inner circle of five, average age 72. As long as these leaders remain, I don't think that there will be any significant change in Hanoi, but obviously if you look at an insurance company's actuarial table, there probably will be change fairly soon. No guarantee that a new leadership that's thrown up or new elements of a leadership will be any different, but I have a general sense that probably it'll be a little more amenable, a little less isolated, a little less of a kind of bug in amber, which is what the present leadership really is. So I guess that's about it, once over lightly. I'd like to also, just since I have a captive audience here, so there are, I left some cards and a sample of this on the table outside, and if you'd like to be on the mailing list, just take one of the cards and write me. Back to you, Max.
Thank you, Doug. I'd like to just reinforce Doug Pike's assertion about the old leadership. I knew a couple of them, and I'm glad to see they're still in power. Unlike the generation of 45 in Indonesia, I knew most of them, including Adam Malik, and now the only leader I know from the new generation of leaders is Yusuf Wanandi, unfortunately. At least I know you, Yusuf. We were together, we saved Indonesia from the Gestapo coup together. Part was only incidental in that, but between Yusuf and myself, we built him up. Now, to just reinforce what you said, Doug, on the tomb of the Emperor Ming Mang in the ancient royal city of Wei, Ming Mang has an inscription in which he confesses that he had to poison his older brother in order to become emperor. And I think that the Vietnamese are quite frank about the double cross in this manner. And they are still bloody-minded, as usual, really admirably courageous, brave, and stubborn and hard-headed. And I think we're going to have to deal with them for many years to come, because they are really the one true remaining group, not only of Stalinist Leninists of the old code, but also Vietnamese of the old order. Vietnamese and expansionist imperial power long before they ever heard of Karl Marx or communism. And I think that's what worries Thailand most of all, because Thailand is our frontline state of ASEAN. And they're right now shooting things across the border. They're in Ampil. Miss Millie Espinas is going to launch the interrogation of Doug. I hope you're not as cruel to him as Fuad Hassan was to Emerson.
First of all, I would like to express my appreciation for being invited to this exciting conference. I must admit, this is my first time to attend such a very important conference on an issue which is a burning issue, especially to Southeast Asians. I must also admit that Professor Pike has contributed much to the body of literature on Indochina. As a matter of fact, I have been his avid student for many years. But of course, a student exposed to a different environment with different challenges. I hope in the process of my reading the comments, I won't upset my former mentors. Professor Pike's paper examines the SRV's domestic politics and its influence in its internal environment. His thesis can be formulated in the following manner. Political power in SRV, is effectively controlled by the aged dogmatic Marxist-Leninists who have been impervious to radical change since 1975. Given this leadership, the SRB's foreign policies regarding Cambodia and its relations with ASEAN states and its sporadic hostilities with China will take a turn for the worse. There may be a change in Hanoi's present foreign policies, but it is anybody's guess as to what direction this change may take. I consider this view of Professor Pike ominous for Southeast Asians, for after all, we are directly affected by developments in Indochina. However, the topic of the paper is very timely in face of the threat of another Indochina war. A forum such as the one sponsored by a host now can always serve as venue for clarifying issues and demonstrating alternative policies in our quest for regional stability. I shall divide my comments into three parts. First, include some points of clarification regarding what Professor Pike described as the political culture of Vietnam. The second will be on Vietnam's foreign relations, specifically Cambodia, the ASEAN states, and China. And the third concerns the future of regional politics from 1985 onwards. The paper first discusses the political culture of Vietnam as the social base influencing the SRB foreign relations. It characterizes the Vietnamese political culture as orthodox Marxist-Leninist, permeated by Confucianism, and dominated by hardened leaders of the post-war who are incapable of creative thinking. Hence, it brings forth a worldview which Professor Pike calls as dark-edged, pessimistic, and trustworthy, in which betrayal is the norm. This description glosses over the significant lessons that can be drawn from the experiences of the Vietnamese Marxists who have been successful in reunifying a long-divided nation. The Vietnamese Marxists could not have won that war against the strongest power on earth, the United States, if they were inflexible and did not apply Marxism-Leninism creatively in accordance with the objective conditions obtaining in Vietnam at the time. Marxism-Leninism has been Vietnamized as it has been Sinicized in China. The view that Asian Marxism blindly follows Marxist principles as these were practiced in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Europe prevents an objective appreciation of the fact that Marxism in Asia has been applied differently in order to suit the conditions. It has gained inroads into societies considered as tradition-bound and has attracted many Asian counter-elites as an alternative course to nation-building. The Vietnamese experience, contrary to Professor Pike's observations, reflect a most dynamic application of Marxism-Leninism in contemporary Asian politics. Another characteristic of this political culture, which Professor Pike considers relevant in the understanding of SRB's foreign policies, is the concept of Dao Chan. He gives the literal translation of Dao Chan as a struggle, although he considers it to mean much more. Any attempt to interpret the concept of struggle in the context of Vietnamese experience will be just an approximation on our part since we are merely observers of their praxis. However, I quite agree with Professor Pike that this concept can border on armed struggle or political struggle depending on the dominant political phenomenon obtaining in Vietnam. I would like to invite Professor Pike to examine this concept on another level. This may even give us the clue that Vietnamese Marxism is indeed highly creative in the hands of the veterans in Hanoi. The other level which I can think of regarding Dao Chan is the intellectual level. Dao Chan is similar to other Dao Chans in Asian societies. In the Philippine example, we have this concept. The word makibaka, which can be literally translated as to struggle, is very closely related to the Dao Chan of the Vietnamese. However, this concept has been redefined by the Philippine left as not only to dare to struggle, but to subject to re-examination existing ideas as they are used in contemporary life. I believe this other level of interpretation is crucial because it will give us certain clues why these orthodox Marxists, as you call them, were able to liberate South Vietnam. I will not attempt to belabor this, lest I also commit the error of misinterpreting Vietnamese practice. A further study of this concept may prove to be an interesting research topic. You discuss a third characteristic of this political culture, the economic schizophrenia, which is your words, of the present Hanoi leadership. Again, I find this insufficient to explain why the SRP's leadership has been unable to propel its country to economic development after 1975. Perhaps a review of the consequences of America's involvement in that country could give us a well-rounded understanding of why Vietnam, as you say, extremely poor. I quite agree with you on the point of Vietnam's poverty, but I will disagree with you that the leadership has sacrificed steps toward national development for the sake of keeping their Marxist ideology pure. In almost a century of war with the French colonialists and later with American neo-colonialist forces, it can be said that present-day Vietnamese have not known any other existence except that spent in the defense of their territory. Considerable human resources were mobilized in this national effort. Production had to serve this national effort, while after the Second World War, their Southeast Asian neighbors were already on the road to nationhood, drawing up economic development plans. Surely these countries had had a lead in economic strategies as a result of East-West interaction. For the Asians, Western colonialism is partly responsible for the economic malaise which is today confronting many third world economies. You might have a different opinion regarding this matter, but to the Asians, this is an inescapable reality. In the 5th National Congress in 1982 March, Vietnam adopted a comprehensive program for national development. Evidently, the Hanoi leadership saw the importance of making national development a priority in all its national activities. It is true that Hanoi's military action in Kampuchea in December 1978 has diverted much of the needed resources that could have been used for rebuilding Vietnam. Even with this emergency situation since 1978, agricultural production has been raised to a higher level, as evidenced by the fact that there is a little bit more food in the market in Vietnam than during the war. In the countryside, there are more fruits, crops, rice, etc., to feed the growing population. This array of food products are really very modest if we compare them with other levels of production in Southeast Asia. I agree with Professor Pike that the style of agricultural production in Vietnam is primitive, but not irrational. In northern Vietnam, one sees thousands of bomb craters marking its earth. With bare hands, the Vietnamese turned these bomb craters perpetrated by B-52 bombers into hydraulic systems, which have been able to trap flood waters coming from the Red River when the waters recede. One can see this even along the highways entering from the Hanoi airport. Some have been turned into fish ponds where it was possible. No capital outlay was needed to construct irrigation networks the way millions of dollars have been expended in the Philippines. If you recall your Dauchan, this is an example of daring to struggle to turn a bad thing into a good thing. In your discussion of the political culture of Vietnam, you overlooked the massive efforts in education being undertaken by the government of Vietnam. There has been a nationwide movement to raise the level of education, specifically in the South. Thousands of Vietnamese have been sent to train, mainly in the USSR and Eastern Europe, some to Japan, to the Philippines, to Malaysia, and a few to the United States. Given the thrust in education, Vietnam is preparing the ground for future takeoff. I will now come to the second part of my comments, which is on the foreign relations of SRV. His analysis of the relations between the SRV and its Indochinese neighbors, that is Laos and Cambodia, is good. I will not dwell on this topic, but I will just add one point of interest which is related to the economic survival of Vietnam. SRV's military action in Cambodia could also have been impelled by economic consideration. The SRV could not stand for long the hostility of the Pol Pot group, who had threatened to disrupt Vietnam's reconstruction efforts since 1975. It did not give them a breathing space since the Khmer Rouge decided to adopt an independent foreign policy from that of SRV. Agricultural production was disrupted in Thái Ninh as the result of the border skirmishes in 1977-78. I doubt that the foreign policy of the SRV lacks an economic consideration to guide its decision-making. However, the most important consideration for this military action in Cambodia, as you correctly pointed out, is the fact that democratic Cambodia would constitute the weakest flank in the defense of the Indochina Peninsula. For the Vietnamese, Indochina must be protected from hostile forces. even at the cost of international censure, not to mention criticism from the socialist camp. This, to my mind, is the Achilles heel of the SRV. As regards Professor Pike's digression on ASEAN-Vietnam relations, I get the feeling that he dooms whatever attempts by individual ASEAN government for a rapprochement with SRV. You must have discerned from Indonesia's and Malaysia's statements in 1976 and 77 that their governments were willing to assist SRV in the reconstruction effort in Vietnam. Or even the Philippine government has expressed in early 1983 of its desire to accommodate SRV despite its criticism on its military action in Cambodia. This trend of forging a modus vivendi, to my mind, transcends ideological disparities, more so searches for means whereby these states live in harmony. Culturally, the ASEAN peoples and Indochina had historical ties that can be cultivated to forge a meaningful interaction. In contemporary international relations, these states, whether communist or capitalist, must continue Song's interferences to search for a viable relationship where respect for each other's political ideals and cultural beliefs must be the basis for interaction. Your discussion on SRV-China relations is good. I will not dwell on this. Part three of this paper I consider important, but the conclusions are far from satisfactory, primarily because they end by saying that we really will not